Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. I have a few things I'd like to rant about, if I may use my host's privilege to do so, and they may stimulate some thoughts on your part as well. And then we'll get into it, basically. We've got the whole day to talk here. I want to start out with cancel culture. And I'm going to get to why the Republicans are doing this in just a minute. But first, let's talk about what they're doing. For example, in the 3rd Congressional District of Michigan, this is up in the Grand Rapids area, you know, the area that used to be represented by the guy who said, you know, yeah, let's go ahead and impeach Trump. That guy's been replaced by Peter Meyer. Now, I grew up in Michigan. Meyer's is a big grocery store chain that has become kind of like a Walmart chain across Michigan. In fact, I think they've spread across the Midwest. And Peter Meyer is from the family that owns that, a billionaire family. And he beat in the primary a guy named Tom Norton, 50.2% to 15.8%. Tom Norton got 15% of the vote, lost to Peter Meyer. Peter Meyer is now the Republican congressman from Michigan's 3rd Congressional District. But Tom Norton's the loser. His website, he's still accepting donations. And he is asking, in fact, he's asking for $45.20 because Trump was our 45th president and he was reelected in 2020. Don't you know? Joe Biden didn't actually win the election, according to this guy. So this guy comes out and he tweets, "The government cannot take my Goya beans, my Mr. Potato Head, my Dr. Seuss books, or my AR-15. Come and take it. This is America. I'll eat my green eggs and ham on Christmas in my pickup truck if I want to. Enough cancel culture." Cancel culture? And by the way, later in the day, Target, you know, the store chain, the chain store all around the country, they announced that even in states like Texas and Mississippi that have ended mask mandates, they are still going to require people in their stores to wear masks. And so he tweeted, "Boycott Target. Cancel Target." But what is this all about? You know, well, first of all, last year, while Donald Trump was still president, the foundation which holds the estate of Dr. Seuss announced that 6 books, and they're all relatively obscure ones that he wrote way back in the day, 5 of them characterizing Asian Americans in ways that are highly stereotypical. I'm not even going to describe it. And 1 describing African Americans as monkey-like creatures. They're going to pull those books. Now, Fox has been going hysterical about this. Oh my God, this is cancel culture. The government didn't make this choice. The people who own the books made this choice. And they made it while Trump was president. But Fox is still, oh my God, we're hysterical about this. Weirdly enough, Fox will not show those pictures on TV that they say shouldn't be canceled because they're racist pictures. So Fox is saying, oh my God, they're canceling something that shouldn't be canceled, but we can't show it to you. We're going to cancel it. Are you following this? And then Mr. Potato Head, Hasbro, you know, one of the biggest toy companies in the world, years ago added Mrs. Potato Head. In other words, there's a, you know, you can get female accessories. In fact, they did away with the potato years ago. Now they've got a plastic potato because people were complaining about potatoes getting really grody and their kids wanting to hang on to them. And so now it's all plastic, but it's a plastic potato. And then you put things on it and you can make it into Mr. Potato Head. Or you can make it into Mrs. Potato Head. They've got, you know, all the wig and makeup and, or not makeup, but, you know, lipstick and stuff like that. And so, hey, we're marketing a product that both boys and girls can use. So let's stop calling it Mr. Potato Head and just call it Potato Head. And you can make it Mr. Potato Head or you can make it Mrs. Potato Head. And that's what they did. They made this decision again while Donald Trump was. It was only recently announced, but Joe Biden had nothing to do with it. The Democratic Party had nothing to do with it. The U.S. government had nothing to do with it. This is called free market capitalism. But Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson are literally hyper, well, I don't know if they're literally hyperventilating about it, but it sure looks like they are. Oh my God, cancel culture? You can't have Mr. Potato Head anymore? It's now gender neutral Potato Head? In fact, somebody even edited the Wikipedia page, and maybe it was well-intentioned, I don't know, but they said, you know, you drop the Mr. Moniker to make it gender neutral. Well, no, it's not like they're saying, we've got a general neutral potato head. Or, you know, as Fox News and right-wing hate radio is implying, we've got an LGBTQ potato head. That's not what they're saying. They're saying our potato head is no longer branded as Mr. It's no, we're no longer just marketing this to boys. Which brings us to Jennifer Rubin. Jennifer Rubin was a Republican, a conservative. She writes for the Washington Post, has for years. She's an old line William F. Buckley conservative. Jennifer Rubin says in today's Washington Post, the headline, the MAGA phenomenon has never been about economics. And she points out that Republicans claim to be all about the blue collar middle class, the working class guy, the working class Joe, the people who go to NASCAR. But in fact, Republicans backed a tax cut for billionaires. They tried to strip health care coverage from tens of millions of Americans. They insisted that frontline workers, including older people who work at, like, you know, Walmart and whatnot, must prioritize the economy over their own health, that being the stock market. In fact, you know, the number two guy in Texas, Dan Patrick, even said, you know, older people should die for the, you know, the economy. And they're continuing to do this. So she points to this thing. She says the MAGA phenomenon was never about economic dislocation. A 2018 study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences concluded that, quote, white Christian and male voters turned to Mr. Trump because they felt their status was at risk. The MAGA Republican Party, she says, has never represented the interests of working and middle class Americans. Instead, they represent the interests of those motivated by xenophobia, racism, and misogyny, whatever their economic status. Statistically, voting for Trump correlates most closely. The one thing that you can constantly and consistently show among voters who voted for Trump is that the majority of them are white, not African American, is that the majority of them believe that white people, not African Americans, are discriminated against and are watching Fox News. This is from Jennifer Rubin. She points out that among people making less than $100,000 a year, Joe Biden took 57% of the vote in the last election. Donald Trump only got 35% of people making under $50,000 a year. It's basically high-income white people who are essentially racists pushing and voting for Trump. So, cancel culture? No, it's a distraction. They're simply trying to change the subject away from the fact that the Republican Party is all about helping rich people, billionaires, and giant corporations, and screwing the middle class, working class people. They don't want you to have a union. They don't want you to have a minimum wage. They don't want you to have health care. They don't want your kids to go to college for free. I mean, and they're pretty upfront about it. John in Boise, Idaho. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
It's my turn to rant now. Hey, okay. Nobody's going to take my potato head. I'm trying to figure out if it's male or female or Republican, Democrat, or independent. But that's not what I called about. Anyway, I'm calling about the I don't believe that we should have sanctions against Russia for putting that activist in prison for 2 years. I believe it's wrong. But I also believe we have a long list of judicial problems in this country. The system is broken. We put people in there, and men and women in there for, what, decades, two or three decades. Then they come out with DNA, say, oh, they're innocent. And a lot of them, they knew they were innocent in the first place. They just had to have somebody to put in there. But anyway, I don't think it's right to put a sanctions on Russia for doing that. Because of what we
got going on. After talking to Richard Wolfe, I'm inclined to agree with you, although I think that there does need to be a response. And I think the sanctions specifically were to the poisoning of Navalny, which happened when Trump was president. Of course, Trump, you know, wants to build a Trump Tower in Moscow, so he, and God only knows what else. So, you know, he's not going to criticize anything coming out of Russia or a half a dozen other countries, you know, where he has Trump Towers or wants to have Trump Towers or where there's billionaires that have supported him and his buddies. But I'm not sure that economic sanctions have ever worked. And, you know, we'll see. But John, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Ed in Pine Bush, New York. Hey, Ed, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, it's great to finally get through to you. I've got something that will first strike you as a little off the wall. It's some geeky science that may explain a number of things that you've been talking about over the past couple of weeks, like maybe the psychological profile of a Trump supporter, or the bigger picture. Okay. What inspired me to call was your suggestion that we think about the coronavirus and what's happening to us in terms of the big picture, in terms of Gaia and its self-correcting mechanisms.
Right. Well, Ed, let's get right to it because we just have 1 minute.
Okay. My source of authority on this is a guy named David Suzuki, who has a program called The Nature of Things. And he had a whole program devoted to the parasitic control of our brains. And he goes through...
Oh, are you talking about now cryptosporidium?
No, I'm talking about, what's it called?
Okay.
Toxoplasma.
Anyway, toxoplasma, this stuff, yeah. Toxoplasma is caused by an organism called cryptosporidium, isn't it?
Oh, well, I don't know.
Or is toxoplasma a separate organism? Yeah, okay.
That term didn't come up. I would have remembered it. But anyway, he runs through, like, how these microorganisms get into the brains of worms and grasshoppers and fish and so forth, and particularly into rats, to change their behavior and make them actually attracted to the smell of cat urine so that they will be eaten.
Right.
And anyway, and it goes right up to human beings.
And then the cats get them and they can spread them to us.
Yeah. Well, apparently it's very common among human beings. They're half of the population is affected by this, and they've done epidemiological studies that show that societies that are more authoritarian and that, you know, where people
have more cats,
do suicidal things, or have more of this, you know, a higher incidence.
Whoa.
Of this.
Okay, we
brain.
Have three cats. I'm starting to worry. Ed, thank you. I'm sorry we hit the time thing there. That was a good one. I appreciate it. I just want to share with you some of the things I want to get into. Amazon raised their base wage to $15 an hour 3 years ago. So did that cause jobs to vanish in rural areas, low-income areas, like Republicans claim raising the minimum wage would do? I'll tell you what happened. The chairman of the Fed is speaking out, saying don't get so happy about 6.2% unemployment like they were celebrating on CNN and MSNBC. He's saying don't. Sean Hannity is going after colleges in the $1.9 trillion COVID rescue package, the American rescue package, wrongly. He's misstating the facts and lying about them. Greg Abbott is trying to slur his Spanish. I mean, it's just bizarre. And it's not just him, too. Dan Patrick, too, these slurs. And the Republican senators who are opposing an HHS nominee are taking literally millions of dollars from an industry that this guy wants to regulate. Let's pick up your phone calls here. Lou in Pueblo, Colorado. Hey, Lou, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, good morning. Nice to be kind of bored with politics instead of running from fire to fire. I was going to talk about messaging, but you had asked me, I'm a long hauler with COVID, and you had asked me to call in and update every so often. Well, I've been gradually, it's been about a year, gradually, slowly getting better. I got the vaccine 2.5 days ago, and all these lingering symptoms are just about gone. By Monday, I think I'll have to turn in my long hauler card. So,
did the vaccine seem to help with your long haul symptoms?
Absolutely. They just about vanished in 2.5 days.
That's amazing. That's really good news. I hope somebody's doing some research on that one, Lou. That's fascinating.
Yeah, I'm going to go get a shot every week. But
there you go. So you called about something else.
I like to do things that I can do, because if I make plans for you, well, you may not have time, so I'd rather make plans for me. And I'm actually getting a difference doing this. What I've done is two things. One, I don't use the phrase conspiracy theory. I always substitute in writing and speech impossible conspiracy fantasy. And people back off right away because they know it's a fantasy, okay? So they don't push. They won't push another one on you.
So yeah, you wouldn't even have to insert the modifier impossible. You could simply replace the word theory with fantasy. I think that's brilliant. That's absolutely brilliant. Conspiracy fantasies. Yes.
Well, that's what I do when I'm talking. I say conspiracy fantasy. In writing, I'll say impossible. And it's working. People back off. The other thing is, you know, we have this statement, these unnecessary words. If I say an angry young man went into the liquor store. Well, that's kind of angry young men, something bad may happen. But I hear angry young black man went into the liquor store. Why do you need to say black man? Testosterone poisoning affects you regardless of your skin color. So what I'm doing in talking with people now, I always insert an angry young white man went in here, an angry young man whose race I don't know, because I want to bring up this point of sticking these words in that we automatically connotate that really don't belong there.
Yeah, so it's like Dr. Seuss's stuff.
Awareness.
Yep.
Well, now Dr. Seuss, I grew up at the time he was writing his books. You couldn't find anything that wasn't racist at that time.
Oh, so I agree. Disney cartoons were. Look at how the early Mickey Mouse cartoons were portraying black people as essentially minstrels. Horrible portrayals of Chinese and Japanese. Of course, this was in the decade, in the 1950s, in the decade after World War II when we fought a war against Japan. But still, it was racist depictions. Yes, absolutely. And that's why the Seuss Foundation, or whatever it's called, this foundation that owns Theodore Geisel's work, that was his real name, as I recall, they're saying, we're going to take those out of print. Well, that's fine. That's their privilege.
Yeah, and it wasn't Biden. No.
Yeah, no, it wasn't. No, and it wasn't Democrats, and it wasn't the U.S. government. Lou, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. And I'm so glad to hear that the vaccine actually helped you with your long haul syndrome. That's amazing. Jimmy in Southgate, California. Hey, Jimmy, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I'm first-time caller, long-time listener. Wanted
thank
to
you.
Talk to you about... where do progressives go to retire? I started thinking about this in the past week because I had a former coworker who has been retired for a few years called me out of the blue last week and was all excited to tell me about how they've moved to Arkansas. And then when she described this paradise in Arkansas, it just kind of gave me the chills. They moved to a town called Bella Vista. I don't know if you know it. The next town over is Bentonville. The hometown and the headquarters for the Walton family and Walmart. Anyway, Bella Vista is a 28,000 population, and it's basically a giant gated community. The city has 7 lakes on it, and they're all private. You have to be a homeowner in the city or a guest to be able to access these lakes. Anyway, it's 98% white. My friend said that it's 80% Republican, and she said that she was just scared of moving. she had to move out of California because she didn't feel safe living in California anymore. So they sold their home, moved to this supposed paradise. And she said that, you know, people were, you know, here in California were being held up with armed robberies. And she was afraid that in the next time a black criminal, her words, a black criminal is shot by policemen, there'd be a huge riot and she would no longer be safe. And of course, there's
so Jimmy, what's your point?
Well, so if these racists are moving out of California to these enclaves, where do progressives go to, And so, you know, where's a good place for us to, you know, to find our paradise that isn't racist, isn't white supremacist, et cetera? So,
Yeah, it's interesting that there are communities forming. I mean, it's not surprising. This happened in the 50s after the Brown v. Board decision happened with, you know, private schools, these all-white private academies that opened up all over the South, you know, that led to even all-white universities. You know, Bob Jones was probably the most famous example where he went to court to enforce his all-whiteness, as it were, among other things. So I'm not surprised by that. As far as progressives retiring, I don't see any. I think, you know, progressives represent the majority of Americans. Something like 80% of Americans think that, you know, Social Security and Medicare should be strengthened. Over 70% of Americans think that we should all have a national health care system. Over 70%. Well, actually, in one study we showed as high as 90% of Americans think we should have a higher minimum wage. You know, where you get to 15%, then your support drops down into the 80s. Progressive, we are America. We represent the actual values of this country. We are Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, you know, among others, Hinduism and Buddhism as well. We represent the values of these religions. There was an extraordinary rant on Newsmax where one of their hosts went off on this thing saying Biden is waging a new war on Christianity. He says, so Joe claims to be a devout Catholic, right? The church disagrees. His support of abortion disqualifies him from being a devout Catholic. Well, my recollection is that in Matthew 25, what Jesus talked about was you can't go with me to heaven unless you feed the hungry, visit those in prison, house the homeless, you clothe the naked, heal the sick, right? And I don't recall any time in the Bible where Jesus said you can't have abortions. And so it's like, you know, it's just like this strange stuff, these bizarre people who claim to represent Christianity actually are not representing anything that Jesus ever said. And these bizarre people like your friend Jimmy, who claim to represent America, do not represent the vast majority of Americans in terms of their ideals, their values, their goals, their aspirations. So I think all of America, frankly, is the place where progressives should retire. I think we all need to be in our own communities, you know, wherever they may be, and be doing whatever we can to make them better. There's a great story on Daily Kos today about how Texas, because Texas, you know, young people have moved into Texas, and there's a whole new generation coming up, how a new Texas is fighting with the old Texas, represented by bozos like Greg Abbott. And Texas, I think, in the next 5 years, I think Texas is going to flip blue. And I think much of the rest of the country is. Hopefully. Because that's where we're at.
You're
as a country.
To Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Anyhow, Jimmy, thank you for the call and the provocative question.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. but you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Cliff in Santa Clarita watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Cliff, what's on your mind today?
Real quick, Brother Tom, before I get to my point, I've seen Art Laffer and Stephen Moore telling all their viewers how raising the minimum wage is going to be bad for poor people. You guys are shameless.
Stick around for the next hour.
Yeah, okay. Anyways, the question I have for you, Dom, is Joe Biden playing it too safe? Because what I see happening is, you know, Joe's been trying to be president for decades. He finally achieved his ultimate goal. And is he playing it too safe? He doesn't want to ruffle too many feathers. He's hesitant to pursue the criminals from this past administration. He's not sanctioning MSB.
Well, hang on just a second, Cliff. Let's take these things one at a time. He doesn't even have, basically, you know, a head of the Justice Department. I mean, he's lacking, you know, Bill Barr is gone, but all his people are still there. And Biden doesn't have control of the Justice Department yet. There's still a bunch of Trump holdovers there.
I'm just concerned, Tom, because we remember, I mean, I mentioned this to you a few months ago. I said that the Democrats need to take their gloves off and fight like the Republicans do. Stop being Mr. Nice Guys. Remember when President Obama said he wants to look forward and not behind? We all remember that. Are we going to see the same thing play out with Mr. Biden?
I don't know. We're 2 months into it, though, Cliff. I want him to go big and go hard. And frankly, he's gone much bigger and much more aggressive than Barack Obama did or than Bill Clinton did. And he is taking on the Republicans in a lot of ways. He desperately needs an attorney general. I mean, you've got Merrick Garland, whose nomination now is being held up now by Tom Cotton, you know, has put a hold on Merrick Garland. I think they're going to blow past that. But I think, frankly, the Republicans are trying to delay Garland getting into the Department of Justice because they're afraid of what's going to be found there. And I think some of them are afraid that they themselves are going to, you know, it's going to come out that they themselves have been collaborating with these traitors. And it wouldn't surprise me if Tom Cotton and Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz were among that bunch. They're starting to go through people's, you know, phone records. They're getting skitsy. They're getting worried. But, you know, with regard to things like blowing up the filibuster, I mean, the problem is, I remember living in Vermont in the early 2000s during the Bush administration when the Senate was 50-50. And Jim Jeffords, who represented Vermont along with Bernie Sanders at the time, along with Patrick Leahy at the time, Bernie was in the House. Jim Jeffords was a Republican, and he was occasionally voting with the Democrats. And the Republicans started really ragging on him, really getting on his case. And so he said, okay, screw it, I'll become a Democrat, or I'll caucus with the Democrats. He became an independent. And that immediately flipped control of the Senate to the Democrats. So, I mean, you know, the danger is that if Democrats rag on Joe Manchin too hard, he might just do the same thing that the governor of West Virginia, Jim Justice, did, who was elected as a Democrat and then became a Republican. And Manchin could do the same thing. And then you'd have, you know, hello, Mr. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. So, I think we have to realize that there's some very, very large political fault lines here that Biden's having to navigate. Cliff, thank you for the call. Jerry in Chester, Virginia. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind today?
I don't know if you are aware of this, but the minimum wage was voted on to add it to the COVID-19 relief bill. Were you watching it on C-SPAN, too?
Yeah. I missed that. I knew that Bernie was going to introduce that as an amendment. What happened?
Yeah, it looks like we have more traitors in the midst. The final vote was 58-42, so eight Democrats voted against it besides Senate. Well, Senator Manchin were against it, plus six others, and I try to Google who were the other six, so but it's, you know, it's so disappointing, so disappointing.
Well, what it tells you is that the Democratic Party is not as united as it needs to be if it's going to pass, you know, big progressive legislation, and that means that, you know, we've got a lot of work to do inside our local Democratic parties, showing up at the local Democratic Party, becoming part of it, and building a progressive infrastructure within the Democratic Party so that progressives are put up in primaries and progressives are running in actual elections. so that we can ultimately pass that kind of legislation.
What's going to happen though with the H? I'm afraid, are they going to get rid of the filibuster? Because they're going to have to get rid of the filibuster to pass H.R. 1. So what are they going to do with that?
Yeah.
That's very important.
Well, this was the op-ed that I wrote over at Medium.com, and what I'm suggesting is, I mean, Manchin and Sinema have both said that they love the filibuster because it, quote, promotes debate. Well, in fact, the way the filibuster works right now is not anything like the old Jimmy Stewart movie, you know, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Instead, what you have right now is, you know, if Ted Cruz wants to filibuster a piece of legislation, all he has to do is send an email saying, I object. That's it. He doesn't even have to send the email. He can have his chief of staff send the email. And suddenly, you know, everything grinds to a halt until the Democrats can get together 60 people. If we went back to the filibuster, or not back necessarily, but if we reinvented the filibuster along the lines of Frank Capra's movie, and I think that movie was, 29, it was the late 20s, early 30s. If we reinvented the filibuster like that movie, then what we would say is, okay, Republicans, if you want to filibuster this, you have to have 40 people, 40 of you, have to stay on the floor of the House continuously while one of them speaks. And as long as they're speaking, you can't have a vote. But the minute that you've got fewer than 40 people on the floor, or the minute you're all done talking, there will be a vote. And, I mean, you know, that's just like, and that satisfies Sinema and Manchin's requirement that the filibuster actually encourage debate, which it doesn't do right now. Right now it discourages debate. So I'm calling it the Jimmy Stewart filibuster. And I think that, you know, because we're not going to blow it up, right? It's not, as long as Manchin and Sinema are taking this line in the sand of, you know, we like the filibuster, it's not going to go away. And let's reform it. Let's turn it into what most Americans already think it is. How could you object to that, right?
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
First of all, the big news that I caught this morning watching the news programs on television was that the unemployment rate, that employment went up, that the economy gained a little over 100,000 jobs, and that the unemployment rate is down to 6.2%, which sounds good, right? And in fact, that's how everybody, oh my God, the economy is recovering. And Republicans are now using that as a talking point. In fact, I heard it used three times this morning on television, where they were asking people, well, you know, if the economy is recovering, do we really need a $1.9 trillion stimulus? Well, first of all, it's not a stimulus, it's a rescue package, because you've got 18 million people who are currently taking unemployment benefits. You've got another six or seven or eight million people who can't get unemployment benefits anymore. They've expired on them. They live in states where it's, you know, really hard to do. But, you know, what people are saying is, well, you know, unemployment rate's only 6.2%. I mean, that's a really good sign, isn't it? Shouldn't we just say, you know, everything's good? Well, not so fast. This is from the Financial Times. This was one of their lead stories day before yesterday. It's by Jared Polity and Taylor Nicole Rogers. And they write, the rapid decline in the U.S. jobless rate has so far exceeded the forecast of private sector economists. In other words, hey, sounds like it's good news, right? But the headline figure has obscured far less encouraging trends in America's labor market and is now considered an incomplete and unreliable guide to the trajectory of the U.S. recovery. Something I didn't hear on television this morning. They go on to say, published on, they're quoting Jay Powell, the chairman of the Federal Reserve. This is a speech he gave just about 3 weeks ago. Quote, published unemployment rates during COVID have dramatically understated the deterioration in the labor market, said Federal Reserve Chair Jay Powell during a speech last month, noting that a more realistic unemployment rate right now is closer to 10%. And then, so why is the unemployment rate saying 6.2% when, according to the chairman of the Fed, it should be 10%? Well, it's because people have dropped out of the labor market. And when you're dropped out of the labor market, you no longer are considered unemployed. You're not even counted. You're not counted as employed. You're not counted as unemployed. You're counted as somebody who doesn't want to work, somebody who isn't working, somebody who's a child, somebody who's a spouse, somebody who's, you know, whatever it may be, but, you know, somebody who's just not part of the labor market. They go on to say, since the start of the coronavirus crisis, the U.S. labor force has lost 4.3 million people, 2.5 million of them women. Chairman Powell, again, Jay Powell. The fear of the virus and the disappearance of employment opportunities is the primary cause of the exodus from the labor force. He says older workers are retiring early because they don't want to be exposed to the pandemic. Younger employees are waiting for brighter times in the hope that their skills do not erode in the meantime. So, number one, it ain't as good as everybody says. Number two, now, 3 years ago, Amazon raised their minimum wage, their starting wage, to $15 an hour. And they have places, you know, they've got facilities in very low-wage areas. This is over in the New York Times today by Ben Castleman and Jay Tankersley. When Amazon raises its minimum wage, local companies follow suit. And they do. Amazon has embarked on an advertising blitz this winter about raising the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour, they note. In the areas where Amazon operates, low-wage workers at other businesses have also seen significant wage growth since 2018, which is when Amazon raised their minimum wage to $15. The gains are a direct result of Amazon's corporate decision to increase starting pay to $15 an hour 3 years ago. So, question, did that cause a loss of jobs, like the Republicans tell us, if you raise the minimum wage, jobs go away? Quote, this is from today's New York Times, there is little evidence that raising the minimum wage would lead to significant job loss, even in low-cost rural areas. And then they go to this actual study, this latest study from Brandeis University and UC Berkeley. They studied Amazon, Walmart, and Target, all three companies that pay $15 an hour. And what they found was that wage increases by large corporate employers appear to drive up wages without driving down employment. They call this ripple effects. Well, of course, it's going to drive up wages and employment because people have more money to spend, so they're going to stimulate the local economy where they're spending. They go on to say, in the 1980s, the spread of Walmart and other national retailers helped push down wages as they displaced smaller, often unionized local chains. And of course, they put out of business a lot of small family-owned businesses where, you know, if you know the people you work with, it's really tough to screw them, right? But so they go on to say, now big national retailers seem to be helping push wages up. And then they go on to note, no Republican senator supports a $15 bill, the $15 an hour bill that Amazon, the guys who are fighting unionization down in Alabama, Amazon supports a $15 an hour minimum wage. It's amazing. And here's the proof, right? 3 years, a full 3 years that we can study with three different companies in dozens of communities all across the country where they raise their wages from $7, $8, $9 an hour up to $15 an hour. And not only did it not cost jobs, but it caused all the other wages in the local areas to go up, which is what we used to call the union effect. You know, when 10, 20, 30% of the workforce was unionized, you had an equivalent amount of other companies that raised their wages just to compete with the unions. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. With higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, all into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. It's accessible from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/Hartman with two N's. netsuite.com/Hartman. That's netsuite.com/Hartman.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
By the way, I have the vote on the $15 minimum wage. I just pointed out to you that, you know, good, solid, three-year-long science shows that raising wages to $15, regardless, you know, whether it's downtown San Francisco or whether it's rural Arkansas, it doesn't matter. What it does is it raises wages in other low-wage businesses nearby because now they have to compete with a higher-wage employer. and it doesn't lead to job losses. Instead, it revives local economies. It stimulates local economies. So the science is solid on this. The senators who voted against a $15 minimum wage, it was actually a procedural vote, so they weren't literally voting against the wage. They were voting against the process of including the minimum wage in this $1.9 trillion American disaster relief bill. The senators who voted no were Joe Manchin of West Virginia, Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, John Tester of Montana, Jean Shaheen of New Hampshire, Maggie Hassan of New Hampshire, Chris Coons of Delaware, Tom Carper of Delaware. Delaware, keep in mind, is where half of all the companies listed on the Dow are headquartered. And Angus King, the independent from Maine. And, of course, every single Republican, including, we thought maybe Susan Collins or Lisa Murkowski of Alaska might vote for this. No. So the vote was 58 no, 42 yes for a $15 minimum wage. The Senate is not yet ready to help you out if you are working full time and living in poverty. I'm sorry to tell you. But, you know, step by step, at least we got 42 votes. I think, you know, a year or two ago, Democrats wouldn't have even been able to pull together 30 votes for raising the minimum wage. So, you know, step by step. Anyhow, let's pick up your phone calls here. Jerry in San Francisco. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I'm glad that you talked about the Amazon folks trying to organize. And then from time to time, yeah, you bring up the folks who are trying to organize with fast food workers. And you and I, being from the same parts of the country growing up there in Michigan, I wondered how people view union organizing. To just the average person, is they, okay, they're organizing at Amazon. What does that look like? And I just wanted to share a story with you about what it looked like before the UAW was born in 1900. So he was working at the Ford, I think it was Rouge plant, before the organization of the UAW. And he told one story where he met this woman who comes out from the midnight shift, 7 o'clock every morning. Yeah, they talk for a little bit, and then he goes in. And then one morning, he didn't see her. And he got concerned because, you know, you could be fired for just being sick back then. And so when he went in, her fingers were on the punch machine that both of them use. He using it from the morning to the afternoon, she using it from midnight to dawn. He goes in there, and the foreman says, clean the fingers off and get ready to go. They were actually had a machine where you put your fingers in these heavy gloves, and you move the part, then the part gets flat, and then you move the part back. Well, the automobile production line needed to be sped up, and it almost looked like a I Love Lucy routine with the candies coming down the conveyor belt. So they had to quit using the gloves. So you'd push the piece of metal in, thing would come down with your bare hands, you'd pull it back out before another piece comes down the piece. And she didn't get her fingers out of in time. So he had to show up to this grisly situation where he had to pick up her fingers and throw them in the garbage. That's what the auto factories were like. And he told many, many stories, but I thought that was really the most graphic to remind people or even educate people, because it's for most people under, 45, I don't think you even know what it was like.
Yeah, no, and the history is not hidden. I mean, you know, you can easily, from the Ludlow Massacre forward, and, you know, Woody Guthrie's story and all these, I mean, there's a whole collection of remarkable stories. In my next book, The Hidden History of American Healthcare, there's the story of Tommy Douglas, the father of the Medicare for All program in Canada. When he was 7, 8 years old, they lived in a second floor apartment that overlooked kind of the center of this little town in Saskatchewan, as I recall. And there was a union organizing meeting in the street. The union guys, they were guys trying to organize a union against one of the local companies, or, you know, within one of the local companies. And the police came out and shot several people dead. Tommy Douglas watched that. And he carried that his whole life. I mean, you know, he talked about that all the time. He was very into unions. You know, this would have been probably in the 1920s or the 1930s. So, yeah, you're absolutely right, Jerry. That's a great story. And thank you very much for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
Do appreciate that. Thank you. Mario in San Diego. Hey, Mario, what's up?
Hey, Tom. First time caller. Talking about COVID and depression in kids and suicidal thoughts. It's getting close to home. My son right now, it's been a year. It's been very, very hard on him. It's been pretty hard. And yesterday and today, I had a pretty deep conversation about his thoughts and how he has got no hope and just sees it in such a negative way. And he does blame COVID because it's taken a lot away from him, school, friends. And we've taken COVID pretty serious because we have two family members that did pass away. And I quite don't know how to talk to him and reach to him because I can see he's pretty depressed, hit him hard.
Yeah.
And I like maybe you can give some answers and some kind of way for parents to communicate to their kids. We're all busy, we don't have time, and we kind of just don't think about children and kids and how they see this whole epidemic in their point of view. And I'll take my answer off there. Thank you, Tom.
Okay. Mario, thank you for the call. One of the things that is a relatively consistent feature among people who are experiencing suicidal thoughts or despair in general is that when you ask them what they, you know, if they can imagine themselves a year from now or 2 years from now, if you ask the average person that question, they'll typically kind of look up a little bit, and they're actually looking into their imagination of the future, and they're seeing themselves in the future doing something. And people who are really good at setting goals and achieving those goals are really consistent at this. They will have you can even say, where do you see yourself? And they can point to a spot and say, there I am, and this is what I'm doing, and this is what I'm wearing. And they've got a very fully formed kind of holistic image of themselves in the future being successful or being happy or accomplishing their goals. And when you ask people who are suicidal or in despair, you know, please describe to me yourself a year from now, they will not do that. They will look down, they'll look to the sides, looking down indicating they're kind of dumping into their feelings. They'll look to the sides as if they're trying to have a conversation with themselves about it. Sometimes they'll look up and just kind of flail around. They'll say, I can't see that. And I'm not trying to offer you any specific therapeutic advice, Mario. I'm not licensed to do that. It wouldn't be appropriate for me to do that. But this is a general principle. I'm pretty sure I wrote about this in my book, Walking Your Blues Away. And I also wrote about it in one of my books on ADHD. Actually, there's a whole chapter about this in, I'd have to go back and it got retitled. It was originally called Healing ADD. It's got a new title, but it just came out a year or two ago. But it's called Timeline Therapy. And so the way that you work through that, one way that a person could work through that, is to help people construct a future. You know, what would you like your future to look like? What are the things that really animate you? What are the things that get you excited? How can you imagine bringing those things into your future and accomplishing those things in your future? And, you know, you'll get some opposition to that. People don't want to give up their current state. It's hard to change states, but it is possible. There are a lot of good therapists. Cognitive behavioral therapy is kind of a subset of the sort of thing that I'm talking about. And most psychologists today are real familiar with that, but there's a lot of them out there. There's good therapists who could help. So Mario, I hope that that's a starting point for you, but do not mess around with this. Kids committing suicide is a real thing, and it has gotten worse as a result of the COVID epidemic or pandemic, and not just kids. I mean, people are experiencing despair, and to get past despair, we have to be able to imagine a future. Does any of that make sense to you, Mario?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Check it out, and I wish you the very best. It's really tough. Worrying about our children is just the most difficult part of being a parent. Rodney in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Rodney, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you? I was wondering if you have followed any of the Brexit drama over the last year or so, and what your thoughts are on the parallels with what they're going through and what we've experienced. They're a little behind on it from our state right now.
Did you say on Brexit?
Yeah, I don't know if you followed any of it over there, but I've been doing a deep dive on some of it over the last couple months online, watching some of the older, you know, podcasts and what, and they've got some really good talk shows over there. But the parallels are just really, really scary and chilling. You know, the motivation.
Well, you know, Cambridge Analytica was the British-based company that basically ran the Trump campaign's Facebook strategy, which is what, you know, they credit with his 2016 victory. And they also ran the Brexit strategy. And in addition to this, you had a large number of foreign actors. The Russian trolls have been well identified by the U.S. government, the Mueller report and whatnot, who were engaging themselves in the Brexit stuff in the U.K. and in the pro-Trump stuff in the United States. But there were also foreign actors from other countries that were also encouraging Brits to say, no, no, we hate the European Union. You know, countries that don't like the EU, right? And or see the EU as competition and who don't like democracy in America, and they want to turn America into an authoritarian state. You know, there's two capitalist models out there outside of regulated capitalism that we've historically had here in the United States. And that is communist capitalism, which is being practiced in China and Vietnam right now, and very successfully, by the way, in terms of an economy. What the downside is, it destroys democracy and free speech and personal liberty. And gangster capitalism, which is what they practice in Turkey, what they practice in Russia, what they practice in Hungary, which is where basically the oligarchs run the capitalist system and run the government. And the countries that are big fans of, well, that's what the Republican Party has chosen. The Democratic Party is all in on regulated capitalism. The Republican Party is all in on gangster capitalism, or oligarchy, you could call it. And that's been the, you know, on the world stage, everybody, you know, we used to have this communist versus capitalist. It's not the U.S. versus the Soviet Union anymore. It's U.S. regulated capitalism or European regulated capitalism versus Russian gangster capitalism or Chinese communist capitalism. And these three systems are actually competing on the world stage for domination. Rodney, thank you for the call. And I'm very concerned about how the Republican Party has been embracing gangster capitalism.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archive.
The Tom Hartman University Book Club. We're reading from Walking Your Blues Away, How to Heal the Mind and Create Emotional Well-Being, from Chapter 1, How Trauma Sticks and the Mechanism of PTSD. One of the enduring mysteries in the field of psychology is why the same event produces such different memories and responses in different people. Citing a report in the New England Journal of Medicine, the writer noted, the researchers surveyed more than 6,000 soldiers in the month before and after service in Iraq and Afghanistan. Almost 17% of those who fought in Iraq reported symptoms of major depression, severe anxiety, or post-traumatic stress disorder, compared with 11% of the troops who served in Afghanistan. In World War II, post-war depression and anxiety was called battle fatigue. In World War I, we called it shell shock. The question isn't so much why it happens. We know GIs in war do and see horrific things. The question that perplexes us is why post-war anxiety and depression haunts some veterans and not others. Of course, some vets see harder combat than others, but even that doesn't account for the statistics. There are still huge variations among individual soldiers in how they respond to the same event. The same is true in the civilian world. Some people develop PTSD and others don't, facing the exact same circumstances. In order to understand why some people are still shocked months and even years after a traumatic event, it's necessary to first understand how the brain and mind processes trauma. The brain is a complex collection of deeply interconnected parts and processes. I'm vastly oversimplifying here for the purpose of description. And in light of those caveats, here's a possible scenario that's not inconsistent with much of what's known about brain function. There's a part of the limbic brain, or visceral brain, called the hippocampus that's believed to function as a one-day scratch pad for memory. Everything you experience throughout the day is stored in the hippocampus. In order for the impressions of the experience to become a long-term memory, they must pass through the hippocampus into the rest of the brain. People with a damaged hippocampus remember past events but have extreme difficulty learning new things. Although the rest of the brain is able to integrate recent information from the hippocampus in relation to stored memories, in order to understand that one thing happened a week ago and another thing happened a month ago, the hippocampus knows only one time, today. During the night as we sleep, the hippocampus dumps its information from the day into the rest of the brain for processing, sorting, storing, and disposing of irrelevant information. As the brain is processing the details of the day from the hippocampus, we experience what we call dreaming. Many sleep researchers are convinced that when we experience REM sleep, most of the events, including the traumas of our daily life, are processed. The processing of information management completed, when we wake up in the morning, the hippocampus is once again empty and ready to record another day. The problem emerges when the hippocampus is carrying information that's too much or too hot for the larger brain slash mind to handle. When a recent memory is too strong to be easily and unremarkably processed, it presents in our dream world as a nightmare. If that still doesn't download the information from the hippocampus, then the trauma either becomes buried in the subconscious, a process Freud referred to as repression, or it gets thrown back into the hippocampus the next morning. It's as if the brain says, whoa, that's too much for me to process in one evening. Please hang on to it for another day. When the person wakes up in the morning, the information's still there in the hippocampus, still remembered and known and felt as if it happened that same very day. The conjecture that the hippocampus knows little about the more distant past accounts for the unique feature of true PTSD, that the person feels every day as if the past event happened today, or at least in the very recent past. The trauma is always front, center, new, fresh, and raw. The consequences can be psychologically and emotionally devastating. Every day is affected by a past event. The traumatic event never passes from now until then, and is never processed and filed away in the memory banks, where it loses the power to cause pain and problems on a daily basis. The impact of this on the mind and the emotions is staggering. Brain scans even demonstrate that before a PTSD event has been processed, the amygdala, a part of the brain responsible for strong emotional states, such as those involved with survival or the perception of a threat to survival, and the hippocampus are not functioning normally. The brain scan makes it possible to, in a way, see the effect of the stuck memory. After processing the memory, these parts of the brain usually return to normal functioning. One of the key concepts of many schools of psychology is that human beings are most functional when every part of the mind has access to all other parts. In particular, this functionality is a matter of having full access to positive resources, such as memories of times when we were successful in our undertakings and the good feelings we associate with those accomplishments. Working from this level of functionality, then, when we take on a new task, for example, we first remember times in the past when we attempted something similar and accomplished our goals. This functionality can be accessed in all endeavors, from embarking on a new love relationship to making your first public speaking engagement. Memories of past accomplishments and capabilities are stored in parts of the brain far from the amygdala and the hippocampus. The amygdala and hippocampus, part of our brain's most primary and primitive structures, lie deep in the brain. Thus, having a negative memory stuck deep in the hippocampus blocks the pain and fear associated with that memory from reaching and associating with positive memories and resource states, which are housed in more distant parts of the brain. So in other words, if we don't get these traumatic memories out of the hippocampus, then everything coming in gets filtered through that and blocked having access to resource states that can help and heal us. So the rest of the book is how to get that stuff out of the hippocampus. The book is Walking Your Blues Away. Let's see here. Rich in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hey, Rich, what's on your mind today?
Good afternoon, Tom. Thank you very much. I'd like to talk about how I really smell a smear going on for Governor Cuomo in New York, but I'd also like to offer to a previous caller's concerns about mood and self-destruction that the thyroid is this pivotal portion of ourselves that if it's low functioning, if it's a hypothyroid, your mood gets destroyed. And yeah, it's the easiest thing to have it misdiagnosed, believe it or not.
No, I've seen this in my own family.
You've got fine numbers there. You're fine. And yet I had all these other symptoms that were completely dismissed with extra iodine. And mm-hmm. all of a sudden I was, you know, Hercules. And it was pretty cool.
and iodine, I mean, you know, iodine is an essential nutrient for humans. And these thyroid disorders, Synthroid is the most widely prescribed drug in the United States, prescription drug.
But it don't
and
work.
You need
your liver enzymes to be able to make Synthroid work. And most folks are low on their liver function.
Yeah, and one of the more common incidents of this is in women who have had children. And I'm guessing, this is just my personal theory, that producing a baby, because babies need iodine too for their little thyroids, that drains it out of your body. And if you're not eating a lot of seafood, kelp, dulse is spectacular stuff. You put a half a teaspoon of dulse, it's a red powdered seaweed, put a half a teaspoon of dulse into a cup of coffee, and you do that every morning, and you will be full of pep and vim and vigor like you just never imagined.
I'm actually a big proponent for a Lugol solution, which is super easy to use. It's for the name of the 1700s French biologist, Lugol, L-U-G-O-L, apostrophe mm-hmm. S. So check that out. That's super easy to use. But
is that the iodine you put on your skin?
Well, I got a secret to tell you, sir. You can use it orally, too. You put it. I use this stuff called Calm, which is a magnesium supplement. And I mix that, mm-hmm. and it's because magnesium is a cofactor to the iodine. And I mix that up as the drink, and then I put 7 drops of my 2% in, and that's first thing in the morning, and I'm good to go. So,
yeah,
you know, it's super simple, and we don't have it in our diet in ways because of the way agriculture is practiced, and where it was the the additive in fortified salt, people don't use salt because they're afraid of hypertension.
Yeah. Well, the goiter epidemic is why we got iodized salt to begin with. With regard to Governor Cuomo, I don't know if he's being smeared or not. I do know that, you know, he's a bully. I mean, you know, everybody, brags about that.
He makes things happen. He made tough decisions. Fox is up to its hips in criticizing him. And that tells me that there's a stink. So,
yeah, or they're just being opportunists, one or the other. I think time will tell here.
Absolutely. You know it.
Yeah. Rich, I got to run. Thanks. Special thanks to Louise Hartman, Sean Taylor, Nate Atwell, Jamie Holly, Joyce the Hammer, Nance, Nigel Peacock, Sue Nethercutt, Patrick White, Gerilyn Halbert, Ron Hartenbaum, Chase Spross, Nicholas Miller, Pat Sweeney, Jabbermocky, and Jay LeBlanc. All the folks who help make this show work for you, and thank you for helping, you know, helping keep us going. Be good to yourself and those around you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.